This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
From the Classics Department of UT Austin, I'm Tariq Zayer. This is Sophocles Antigone in 2019. Today, Antigone offers one last lament before going down to her tomb to die. It's the last thing we'll ever hear her say. Also, as she leaves, the chorus gives a bizarre ode that has left even the top commentators scratching their heads. It's like no other choral ode we've seen, and some scholars have argued that it's merely garbled filler. But maybe, just maybe, it's the most genius ode of the entire play. This is episode 14.
O geis thebeis astu patroion, kai theos.
Antigone is a 15-year-old girl who has just been sentenced to death by starvation in a cold, dark tomb deep underground. When we find her, she is being led down to her tomb. She is mournful, spiteful, and deeply alone.
Hoia pros hoion andron pasco. Ten Eusebian Sebisasa.
These are the last words we ever hear Antigone utter. They translate to something like, O land of Thebes, town of my fathers and ancestral gods, I am led away, and I await no more. Behold, high ruler of Thebes, the sole woman remaining of the royal line. What kinds of things I am suffering, at the hands of what sort of men, for having revered piety. If you listen to the Greek closely, you notice that Antigone uses a lot of masculine words in the beginning, such as patroion, which comes from patros, or where the Germans get their word for pater, father. And she also uses hoi koiranidai, which is the masculine plural noun for the high rulers of Thebes. And this is in contrast to how she describes herself and her justice. She calls herself the tain basileidon, the last, you know, sole remaining woman of the royal line, and her sort of feminine justice. She's being persecuted for her justice, which is supposedly feminine, and yet these masculine men are the ones who are persecuting her and locking her away. And so she's sort of contrasting that through the use of her Greek and which gender she uses in the verbs and the nouns and in the speech. But then, seemingly out of nowhere, the chorus starts waxing poetic in these obscure and untranslatable poetry about these bizarre myths that nobody has heard of. As Antigone is walking down to this horrible death, why would Sophocles make them do that now? What the heck is going on? First, I should explain what each of the three myths are. The first story is about a girl named Danae, whose father was the king of Argos. One day, he was told by the Delphic oracle that she would bear a son who would kill him. So he did what all loving family members seem to do in this play. He shut her up in a bronze chamber in his palace. Eventually, however, Zeus snuck his way in, and she bore the hero Perseus, who would eventually accidentally kill his grandfather by hitting him with a thrown discus. The prophecy came true. The second myth is about a man named Lycurgus, who is said to have attacked the female attendants of the god Dionysus, as well as the god himself, and as a consequence, was imprisoned in a cave before being torn apart by wild horses. Now, the wild horses thing is kind of out there, but if you're paying attention, you might think you've noticed a common thread here. Danae locked away in a bronze chamber, Lycurgus locked away in a rocky cave. Maybe the common thread is that the stories have people locked away, just like Antigone. Well, think again.
Philaulos te rethese musas
The third story is about Cleopatra, who has no relation to the Egyptian lady who's famous of the same name. But this Cleopatra, the Greek one, married a man named Phineas, who was a Thracian king, and gave birth to two sons with him. But then he falls in love with another woman, Eidothea, and marries her and puts Cleopatra away in a prison. So the two children are just roaming around the palace, I guess, and the stepmother, Eidothea, decides to put out both of their eyes, each of them, with shuttle needles, and has them imprisoned too. At least this is what we know from other sources. We know it's not actually mentioned in the ode itself, though. That's what's odd about this. It just talks about the tragedy of the children and their eyes. Here, I'll read the English translation so you can see for yourself. By the sea of the dark rocks, the double sea, are the headlands of the Bosphorus and the Thracian city Salmydessus, where Ares the neighbor watched as there was inflicted on the two sons of Phineas the accursed wound that blinded by the savage wife, the wound that made sightless the cursing orbs of the eyes, smitten by the bloody hands and the points of the shuttle needles. Pining away, they wretchedly bewailed their wretched suffering, having been born of a mother whose marriage was nullified by grief. She was the seed who descended from the ancient lines of the Erechtheians, but was reared in far-off caves among her father Boreas's storm winds, running swift as a horse, erect over the mountain, child of the gods. But even upon that one, the long-lived fates bore hard, child. And that's the end of the choral ode. As you can see, it makes no explicit mention of the imprisonment in that story, but the interesting thing is that every ancient member of the audience would have known that story by heart, and just by mentioning the blinding of the children, Sophocles would have put the image in their minds of their subsequent imprisonment and their mother's imprisonment. This is something poets do often. They reference something that makes you think of something related to what they're saying. But by focusing on the sort of gruesome and really tragic acts of blinding the children in the final and third part of the ode, Sophocles is able to really spell out the sadness and the suffering of the children and relate that to Antigone's deep, you know, depression and loneliness and sadness that she feels. And you notice at the end of the third, she says Cleopatra, she was running swift as a horse, erect over the mountain when she was a child. This is sort of in reference, I think, to the second part story in the ode, where Lycurgus is trampled by wild horses. And so it all kind of ties together if you analyze it in the right way. But on its surface, especially if you read the Greek, it seems like poetic gibberish of these three stories that kind of have some things in common, but when you really think about it, have nothing in common. But we have to remember that Sophocles was writing for an ancient audience that was familiar with these stories, and even though we have no idea what they're about, the audience members would have thought about these things. And so Sophocles really does a beautiful job here of making you feel sadness, tragedy at Antigone's situation. And another common thing is that all three people in the stories are high-born, are noble, and yet they still meet these really tragic fates. Antigone, too, is high-born. She comes from a royal family. And part of the sadness of her situation is that she feels she doesn't deserve this fate. And the chorus here, and Sophocles by extension, is sort of saying, look at these people. You know, they thought they were invincible, too, and they suffered these tragedies. And perhaps it's a consolation to Antigone as she goes down to her tomb, but perhaps it's also a warning, or a reminder at least, to the audience that, look, you too might think that you're immune to these kinds of tragic fates, but look again, listen to these stories, you might not see it at first, the relation, but when it happens to you, it might come together more easily. I've been Tariq Zaher. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast was made as the final part of our Teacher of the Day project for our class, which is basically our amazing professor, Dr. Beck, gives us 30 minutes to just teach the class however we choose in our own way. She gives us certain lines of the Greek play we're reading, which I talked about today, and we basically have free rein to teach however we want. So it's really stressful. I was stressed, at least, or anxious. And so I read, you know, all the commentaries, and I, you know, parsed each word in the passage that I had in case someone asked me. And then when I went up, it was totally fine. No, nothing went wrong. No world crumbled around me as I thought would happen. It went well. And so that was a really big, great lesson for me, not just in like academia and teaching, but just in life in general. It was nice to have that kind of realization that you don't have to be perfect. You can still be beneficial and help people if you do your best. So anyways, the format that I did for my Teacher of the Day was Jeopardy, but I don't really know Jeopardy that well, so I just did what I thought a fun version of Jeopardy would be like if it was what I thought it was. So it was very convoluted, but it still worked out really well. There was candy involved and like blessings by Zeus via Tic Tacs if you got stuff right, and that seemed to engage people, and they liked it, and everyone participated a lot. And what was interesting about the experience was I read all of these commentaries and, you know, interpretations of the passages, and then in the discussion, people said things that were totally unique and original that I hadn't encountered before. And so I think that was another cool part of the experience, is like when you're a teacher, you get to experience these fresh ideas and perspectives every day. And I really enjoyed that. So I think something I won't forget from the experience that I definitely didn't expect was Lyle, one of my classmates. So the way the game worked was like, if you answered a question right, you got points in the Jeopardy style. Or if you participated in the general discussion, you also got points. And whoever had the most points at the end got like this box of Sour Patch Kids that I had bought. And so at the end of the class, Nikhil won the box, right? I tallied up the points and I gave it to him. And Lyle came up to me afterwards, or we were just talking in the hallway, and he was like, Tariq, just totally deadpan serious. He's like, Tariq, I could have won. I was trying to facilitate diversity in the discussion. I held myself back, and Nikhil didn't at all. If anything, he should be docked points. I don't want the candy. I'm just saying, as a matter of justice, I think you should revoke his first place. Just totally serious. And for a moment, I glimpsed the terror, you know, that teachers must have to face with graded papers and bureaucracy. And Lyle was totally joking, but it was still a funny experience. Once again, thank you so much for your attention. My name is Tariq Zaher. This has been Sophocles Antigone in 2019, episode 14. I invite you to submit comments if you'd like to discuss on the podcast website, and listen to the other great podcasts that my classmates have produced for me. Thanks so much, and have a great day.